FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today's December 6, 2017. Well, you know, tax cuts. Everybody's talking about tax cuts. It appears that they're going to go through. Who knows? Let's see what happens. Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Well, first, as always, join the show, participate, email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. And don't forget the Twitter feeds at Kerry Lutz. So tax cuts, is it going to have a beneficial effect or is it going to fail? That's really the issue. Well, with us now is a good person who's been involved in the whole swamp and everywhere else. Your name is Harlan Ullman, and Harlan, you've written a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction. Your latest book, which I have not had a chance to read because it just recently released, I think is judging from the title, I believe that could be a major work. It's entitled Anatomy of Failure: Why America Has Lost Every War It Starts. And that's just out. And Harlan, welcome to the show.
Gary, I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
All right. So tax cuts. You're of the opinion they're not going to accomplish the lofty goals that were set out for them.
Not even close. And it's interesting, we'll get to my book, but the same things that cause us to fail when we start wars in terms of bad judgment and absence of knowledge and understanding apply here to the whole issue of tax reform. If you go back, for example, to Sarbanes-Oxley, and you go back to Dodd-Frank, which the first was to deal with corporate misuse, and the second was to deal with financial industries. They both largely failed because they were incomplete. They were passed largely on a partisan basis. But just like this tax reform bill in the House and the Senate, nobody read it in its entirety. And because nobody read it, it's going to be filled with potential time bombs. Now, why will it not work in the main? First, it incentivizes, in my judgment, the wrong things. While I understand a corporate tax cut to 20% makes a lot of sense for other reasons, I would much have preferred if dividends were made tax deductible. That would have incentivized corporations to distribute more dividends to shareholders. It would encourage more people to buy shares, but more importantly, it would increase consumption because it put far more money into circulation. The bill does not do that. Second, with unemployment around 4%, it's very, very difficult to see how this bill is going to increase or decrease unemployment simply because it's at low levels. And I don't see any reason why it's going to increase average salaries for middle and lower class workers. But also, in terms of growing the economy, because it has negative consequence for the deficit, and because nobody has dealt with the additional $10 trillion in deficit that are going to accrue over the next 10 years or so because of skyrocketing costs for Social Security and Medicare and all the other non-discretionary programs, I think this is going to be a great overhead on society and on the economy. And finally, it really doesn't get into infrastructure. This country desperately needs an infrastructure program to repair its roads, its bridges, its tunnels, its airports, its internet, its electrical power grid, everything that you can think of. And I have argued for a very, very long time that corporate money held abroad, the sum $2 or $3 trillion, should have been repatriated here to be invested, however, in an infrastructure bank that would pay, say, 2% above prime 30-year bonds to be guaranteed by the government and repaid with user fees, tolls, et cetera, et cetera. You throw $2 or $3 trillion into repairing the infrastructure. That's 10% roughly of our GDP. That's going to put in place a more dynamic America for the 21st century. And as a final throwaway, Kerry, what happens when interest rates go to 5%, say? That means with a $20 trillion deficit, we're going to be spending roughly $1 trillion a year on deficit on interest payments, which is somewhere around 20 or 25% of the federal budget. I don't see the tax bill really accomplishing any of its purposes. It was sorely needed. I don't think it simplified the tax code. And of course, we'll see what happens when the House version, which is somewhat different than the Senate version, meets in conference, whether they get anything out of it. But to make the larger point, if you didn't read a bill before you voted on it, you should not have been in Congress. And unfortunately, everybody who voted on the bill didn't read it.
I thought you had to pass it to find out what was in it.
Absolutely.
So, hey, but seriously.
Top secret. Yeah, I wish we kept our intellectual property as close hold as we did the tax bill before it was voted on.
Yeah, well, a couple things, though. Number one, when you say unemployment is at this low, unemployment U1 might be, but U6 is still pretty high, probably over 10%. So there's plenty of people to be hired. The artificial U1 rate, which is at around 4%, is really bogus because that's only people who are actively looking for work or collecting unemployment. So the actual rate, I think we could agree, is much higher.
No, I agree with that. But getting people into the workforce, I don't see how this is going to do it because, quite frankly, corporations are not going to be incentivized to hire more people. They're going to buy back their shares. They're going to use that money for other purposes, unless it were directed specifically into programs would do that.
Well,
so
I just don't think
that the bill is going to be able to achieve the things.
Well,
now, are you going to say, are there going to be some advantages? There'll be a few, and I think the tax code is irrational and it's onerous.
So
anything that can be done to improve it obviously is necessary.
Well, the one thing, though, is that most jobs, the job drivers in the economy are small businesses.
And absolutely.
All right. So if you're a small business person and you're paying at the maximum rate, which is 39.4%, I believe right now that's the federal rate, you're going to have a cut down to 25%. So that is definitely going to be a boom for smaller and medium-sized businesses. The big businesses, let's face it, Harlan, since I've been alive, GE has not paid income taxes. And I would venture to say that if I last another 60 years, they still won't be paying any. Nothing's going to change that. And one other
thing. I'm glad you raised GE. I think that's a great example because Jeff Immelt was fated as a great CEO. He was in charge for, when it was 16 years, and he basically ran the company in the ground. You're right about small businesses, but you also have to include state and local taxes. So the 25% rate, I think rate should be much lower, but that still comes into about 40% of the load when you add everything else up. So it's still going to be a pretty big burden, even on small businesses.
Agreed. I'm not disagreeing with you. I just think that, Harlan, there's winners and there's losers in everything. And there are some definite winners here. How big they'll be, I think, is open. And believe me, I'm not saying this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, although I don't think sliced bread was that great either because it probably led to the obesity epidemic. But I think overall, as opposed to doing nothing, I can't remember what John Maynard Keynes said or Smith, but something to the effect of that, considering what could be done and what was done, it could have been worse, basically.
Right? I'm not sure on that, Kerry, but my point is it was a huge opportunity that was missed. And I go back, you take a look at Sarbanes-Oxley, you take a look at Dodd-Frank, we could have done so much better. And I think we could have done so much better in this particular tax bill. And quite frankly, I just don't think it's enough for what's been accomplished simply because we have pressing debt and deficit. And Congress does not have the backbone to deal with these kinds of things. It might have through tax reform. But, a $20 trillion national debt, which is going to increase over time, that has got to be fixed. We can't seem to take on entitlement programs. And so I agree with you. There's going to be a few positive things, but in the main, in terms of the larger issues of really growing the economy, of really establishing some degree of equity throughout the tax system, dealing with our infrastructure, this bill does not accomplish it. It's a great pity, but the fact of the matter is the number one threat to this particular nation is a broken government. Government is simply just not working the way it should, and it's manifested in this particular tax bill, as well as other things that government is doing.
You make some really good points, and that some would argue you can't allow, that basically perfection is the enemy of excellence.
Enemy of the good, of course, but you need to have something that's good, and we could have gotten a lot better. Look, in 86, Reagan was able to mobilize through Tip O'Neill the Democrats, and unfortunately, because our politics have become so vindictive, so pernicious. Republicans don't speak to Democrats. If the Democrats were in charge, we'd have the same problem. And when you lose civility and compromise, you lose the ability to govern. And that's what really worries me most. It's at the heart of our major problems. It's one of the reasons why we have not done as well in wars as we should have since the end of World War II. And it raises the question of whether or not a government and system of politics designed by the best minds of the 18th century can withstand the rigors of the 21st century. And by that, I don't mean America is the end of America. That's nonsense. But if you look at the polls, 75% of Americans today not only do not trust government, but they don't believe the future is going to be better for their children and grandchildren. And that signifies, if it actually turns out that way, the end of America's promise and the end of the American dream, which would be a great shame.
Agreed, yeah.
That's the issue we face, but it's not existential. The barbarians are not storming the gate. The Russians and the Chinese are not the problem. We think they are. The Islamic State can be dealt with, even North Korea. But it's at home where we have the biggest issues. And quite frankly, when you take a look at the last four presidents, none of them were really competent enough to deal with these issues. None of them had the experience, and for different reasons, they've all made huge mistakes. Mr. Trump has been in office for a short time, but he hasn't had the time yet to do what his predecessors did. But not since George H.W. Bush, in my mind, have we had a really competent guy as president. And of course, Bush was never reelected.
Yeah, well, you know, I always felt that he didn't really want the job anymore when he ran for reelection. He just seemed to be.
I think he did, but he had Graves' disease, which had been debilitating, and he really thought that there's no way that Bill Clinton could challenge him. And he also had the problem of Ross Perot, who took 19% of the vote.
Oh, yeah. Perot was really the reason when you get down to it. But I felt like he had lost his enthusiasm for the job. Just his general, I don't know, demeanor. He just seemed kind
of
beat.
In 91, Kerry, he had a 90% popularity rating after Desert Storm.
I know. Very true.
So there we are.
This is very true.
Anyway, you want to talk about my book because it reflects
absolutely
the broader issues, I think.
So let's talk about the book. So basically, we've conducted all these wars. The only war that's been successful, probably post-World War II, was Desert Storm.
Absolutely.
And that was a temporary victory, I guess. Maybe a Pyrrhic victory.
I don't think it was Pyrrhic. Look, there are three reasons why we've done badly. I mean, go back to Korea, which was a draw, but Vietnam, the war in which I fought, and certainly the second Iraq war. But other uses of force, Bay of Pigs, Grenada and Beirut in 1983, the Libya bombing in 2011, the fact it took us 78 days to get Slobodan Milosevic to back off on the Kosovars in 1999, that was inexcusable, given the fact that we have such a magnificent military. And the reasons are very simple. First, and this applies to the last four presidents. They're not ready for prime time. They lack the experience. There's no school for presidents, as John Kennedy said, but the last four were particularly inexperienced. Donald Trump is even more so. Second, they exercise poor strategic judgment for a number of reasons, ranging from relying on advisors who got them elected who didn't know anything about governing, ideology. During Vietnam, we're going to prevent the commies at the Mekong from getting to the Mississippi. Yeah. We'll pay any price, bear any burden. To George W. Bush in Iraq, that we're going to democratize the greater Middle East in Iraq, and therefore we're going to change the geostrategic landscape of the Middle East, which we did, but not for the better.
Certainly.
And
not.
So that was the bad judgment. And then, of course, the knowledge and understanding of presidents when they use force for the wrong reasons contributes hugely. Before September 11th, only a handful of Americans knew the difference between Sunni and Shia. We went in for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that didn't exist. We should have known better. But similarly, in Vietnam, we didn't understand that there were three or four wars ongoing. And so the lack of knowledge and understanding is something that gets us into huge trouble. And I spent a good portion of the book suggesting how we might be able to change that within the confines of our political system of checks and balances, which really makes taking rational action, unless you have an unusual president like George H.W. Bush or Dwight Eisenhower, very, very difficult.
Okay. So, I guess that, you know, it's a mess and a lot of missed opportunities here. When you're talking about Vietnam, what was drummed into our heads, and I was young at the time, was the domino theory. First, Vietnam falls, then Cambodia, then Laos, and finally Thailand, and then everything goes. And was this like a put-up job, the fear of communism, it being such a threat? So yes, manipulation.
And the fear was, but the fear of the dominoes was not that those governments would fall, because they did. They would fall under a monolithic communist regime that was monolithic in the sense that communist China and the Soviet Union were allied to take on the world. And a lot of the reason was that was our experience in World War II. Mm-hmm. We were facing an enemy fascism, and so it was us or them. And quite frankly, during much of the 20th century, that 20th century really was a binary or bipolar world. In the First World War, it was the Axis versus the Central Powers versus the Allies. World War II, the Allies versus the Axis. And then the Cold War, East versus West. And that's what happened in Vietnam. We didn't understand that Communist China and the Soviet Union had profound differences. We didn't realize how weak the Soviet Union really was. And we were operating on many assumptions that came out of World War II. And similarly today, I think we're viewing the world with a 20th century understanding of what the world is in the 21st century. For example, we base much of our strategy and policy on deterrence, that is, nuclear weapons and the threat of a war. We're going to prevent the Soviet Union from being aggressive. All right, we now have the best Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps in the world. How well has that worked in deterring, for example, the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda? It hasn't. How much has that deterred Russia from moving into Crimea, or active measures in which they've interfered in our elections and in Brexit, the British vote to stay or leave within the European Union? And the point is that the 20th century view does not fit. And unless or until we have to realize we need a 21st construct to deal with the 21st century, we're going to be playing a new game with old rules. And that means it's going to be very, very difficult for us ever to catch up.
Yeah, well, they always say generals fight the last battle, right?
Well, it's not generals, it's politicians. Mm. I have a lot of time for the generals. I mean, one of the problems is we've used the U.S. military as a tool in places where it will not work. It is terrific in using force. It's a terrific and effective military, but it cannot democratize Iraq. It could not build nations in Afghanistan. In other words, there are some things it can do very well, but it's been forced to do things that it cannot do, and it's performed as good as it can, but that's not been sufficient, and that's a lesson we need to learn.
So mission creep and having them doing social welfare overseas, nation building, as they call it, destined for failure.
It will not work.
Yeah.
And worse than that, the greatest threat, and as I said, the barbarians are not the gauge. Your listeners don't have to worry about we'll be speaking Russian or Chinese or even Arabic. That's not going to happen. That's nonsensical. But the biggest threat, as I said, we face is a broken government. And for the Pentagon, I think the Pentagon is headed towards a hollow force through none of its own doing. But first of all, we now have something called uncontrolled internal cost growth for everything from people to precision weapons to pencils because of the nature of the system of about 5 to 7% a year, which means that unless you add $30 or $40 or $50 billion a year to defense, you can't sustain it. We have too many forces deployed in too many places, and we can't afford that either for reasons of money or people. The forces aren't large enough to do that. And we have an overarching management, budgetary, political oversight system that had to be invented by the KGB because it is so irrational that it makes absolutely no sense. And quite frankly, how the Pentagon operates when it doesn't have a budget until the year is almost over, when it has to take arbitrary cuts, when 20 or 30% of its time it responds to needless rules and regulations for oversight. I admire the stamina of our senior leadership to deal with these situations, but I will tell you it's highly unpleasant, and unless we can correct it, the same things that happened after the Vietnam War when we had a hollow force, that's a force that was not sufficiently ready to fight,
right,
that had low morale. It's happening again. You can see the canaries in the cage right now with the Navy collisions. The Air Force is 2,000 pilots short. The Army has few units that are ready to fight tomorrow. This is something people should be worried about.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that Trump did attack the defense contractors, at least once he was elected. I don't know what's going on now, but he went to Lockheed Martin and said, hey, your F-35 costs too much money. You got to cut back.
It had no effect.
Air Force One.
The cost cutting was going. What Trump is saying is basically rhetoric and nonsense. All these things were ongoing. Look, any White House is going to take credit for anything that they want to do. But his notion that he's rebuilding the military is nonsensical. The military is deteriorating under him, and it was deteriorating under Barack Obama. And you have to recognize reality. And if we want to keep a strong military, and I think we do, it's going to be a smaller military, but it's going to be one in which we have to emphasize readiness and ability to fight. And if we are smart enough to do that, and we are more sensible in where we decide to send our forces in peacetime as well as in battle, we can manage. But my concern is that government is not going to be able to do that to the degree that it needs to. And therefore, I am very concerned about the future of our military. And I argue, obviously, very strongly in my book, Anatomy of Failure, why America loses every war it starts. We cannot allow this to happen again.
Yeah, well, from your mouth to God's ears, Harlan, you know, it's
Trump's ear, right?
You can never overestimate the stupidity of government, what it's capable of, the damage that it can wreak, and all of that. And, hey, hopefully somebody will read your book. Harlan, where do we find the book and where do we find you?
What you need to do is just go onto Amazon. I think they've got a sale. That's the easiest place. Barnes and Noble and booksellers everywhere have it. Best way to get hold of me is at Harlan K. Ullman on Twitter. And I respond frequently. I will make one other comment, Terry, if I may.
Sure, please.
Find the what's happening with the tax reform bill. In a column I have coming out, I refer to Will Rogers, who was a great, great, great humorist of the last century, 1920s and 30s. And looking at Congress, Rogers said, every time Congress makes a joke, it's a law. And every law they make is a joke. Yeah. And I'm afraid that applies as much to the tax reform bill as it does anything else. And it's a sorry but true statement. We have a broken government, and we have to do our very best to try to repair it within the confines of our ability. And the one area we really need to focus on, as I said, is preventing our military from becoming a hollow force. And that's going to really require American citizens standing up and demanding of their government that they take this on seriously. And perhaps from there, we can go on to bigger issues like coming up with sensible tax reform, entitlement reform, and all the things that need to be done so the American promise can be sustained in the future for generations as it has been in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm reminded of another American, H.L. Mencken, who happened to say that no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. So I think we got the work cut out for us. Hey, join the show. Email us. I'll pass it on to Harlan. It's kl@carrylutz.com. Twitter feed's @CarrieLutz. Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Hey, Harlan, great luck on the book, and thank you so much
for
coming on.
Thank you. Good being with you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.